The year that was, a president-elect in Palm Beach, a Stanley Cup in Sunrise, horror in Haiti. And the year that will be, more condo panic, garbage crises, and an arts rebound? Welcome to the South Florida Roundup. I'm your host, Tim Padgett. In the next hour, we'll review 2024 and preview 2025 for the paradise, or at least the traffic-jammed region that we call South Florida, and later for that annex of South Florida that we call Latin America and the Caribbean. Our panel of journalists and experts will guide us through the good and the bad that shaped us last year and promise to define this year, like where are we ever going to put that garbage incinerator, and will Venezuela ever be free? All that coming up right after the news. I'm Tim Padgett. Welcome to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. And Happy New Year. Feliz Año. Bon Anné. Feliz Ano Novo. If you're a Republican, 2024 was a red-letter year in South Florida, with emphasis on the red. Donald Trump again won the presidency from his Palm Beach perch, Mar-a-Lago, which is the first South Florida White House since Richard Nixon made Key Biscayne his second Oval Office a half century ago. In the process, Trump won that Democratic stronghold known as Miami-Dade County and turned it Republican red. Even so, Democratic Miami-Dade Mayor Daniela Levine-Cava won re-election, giving her four more years to figure out where we're going to put that new garbage incinerator. Those are just a couple of the stories that define South Florida last year and which promise to preoccupy us in 2025. From Tequesta to Key West, the affordable housing crisis was and still is hanging over us, along with strict new homelessness laws and steep new homeowner association fees. But there's good news, too. The Florida Panthers won the Stanley Cup, West Palm Beach made a bid to become Wall Street South, and the Fritz and Franz Beer House got to stay open in Coral Gables. What do you think were and will be South Florida's top stories and issues in 2024 and 2025? Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Joining me now to survey the ghosts of South Florida past and future are three of WLRN's expert journalists. Here with me in the studio is Joshua Ceballos, our government accountability reporter, and Carlton Gillespie, our Broward County reporter. Also with us is Wilkin Brutus, our Palm Beach County reporter. Happy New Year to you all, gentlemen.
Happy New Year, Tim.
Happy New Year.
Wilkin Brutus, let me start with you up there in Palm Beach County, because frankly, Mar-a-Lago is now the new ground zero, not just for the new American political reality, but in many ways, the new South Florida political reality as well. Trump's palace there is now the second White House, as I said, but how did the Trump effect in 2024 change the vibe in Palm Beach, which is still a Democratic county, but is turning more red, no?
Yeah, absolutely, Tim. Donald Trump definitely led this red shift in Palm Beach County, which was once considered a blue stronghold. He essentially improved his numbers each time he ran for president. But Kamala Harris still won the county in November's election, albeit by 1%. But still, many things can be true at the same time. I actually covered Trump's election watch party. And I now consider the county, Tim, to be an awkward purple color. Because despite the rightward shift, Democrats actually regained control of the county commission this year. Mm-hmm. Prior to this election, Republicans actually held a 4-3 majority, and the makeup is now 4-3 Democrat. And that's because local politics has unique local issues, right?
Right.
But even though there is some silver linings for Democrats, they can't deny, to your point earlier, the Republican gains in our county. And so the Republican shift is, it does feel like it's permanent at this point.
Right. So Mar-a-Lago isn't sort of the political outlier it may have been in years past. It's becoming a lot more part of the neighborhood then.
Yeah, I mean, you call it a palace. It's still a palace. during that night of covering the watch party, Elon Musk was actually there as well. And so it's become this sort of pop cultural spot as well, especially when you consider conservatives have used culture war tactics to lure more voters. But on a statistical sense, there just was more larger Hispanic turnout. Trump seeing a slight boost in black turnout. Republicans gain ground in registrations. Republican campaigns basically outspent Democrats this election season. And in my previous reporting, several Democratic lawmakers told me that the Florida party is weak because national Democrats refuse to make it a priority. Yeah. Well, so there's a lot of issues at hand here for the Democrats.
That brings me down here to Josh Sabai. And by the way, Elon is still there, right?
Oh, yes. Still there.
So, Josh Ceballos, let me then pivot to you, because the Trump effect really did turn Miami-Dade County from blue to red in the November election. Trump became the first Republican presidential candidate in almost 40 years to win Miami-Dade, and he won it big by 11 points. Yep. What happened in Miami-Dade? And even though, as I mentioned, Democratic Mayor Daniela Levine Cava won re-election, how in the world do Democrats here recover from this in the bigger picture?
I mean, so Wilkin made a very good point. A lot of the people that I spoke to from the local party say that the national party almost abandoned them. They were doing, you know, very little engagement with the Florida Democratic Party, and that they weren't getting a lot of groundswell from the Kamala Harris campaign, Harris-Waltz campaign, right, either. And so, I mean, but this is kind of the same drum that they've been beating for the past several election cycles, where Democrats are saying the Republicans have a much better ground game. They're involved in the communities throughout the year, not just before an election. Right,
not just
on an election year, but throughout the entire cycle. They're here, they're registering voters, they're doing constituent services. And meanwhile, the Democratic Party is not registering voters at such a high rate. And so what we saw was a lot of these constitutional offices, like the Miami-Dade County Sheriff and the tax collector and the property appraiser, all those positions were won by Republicans. So all the down ballot races are now filled mostly by Republicans, even though, like you said, Miami-Dade County Mayor Daniela Levine Cava, her position is nonpartisan, but she's largely associated with Democrats. She won, but all the people around her, it's a very red field.
But you made the point earlier, a few weeks ago on this show, that she won in large part because a capital D wasn't by her name in the nonpartisan election in August.
Right. So some people might disagree with me there. But I think in large part, I think with the Trump effect, Republicans saw this big boost. You know, all the boats were raised, including so any partisan races where someone had a R next to their name, Republican, that might have helped them. But for the nonpartisan races, that wasn't a thing. So that could have contributed to Daniela Levine Cava winning.
Carlton Gillespie, Broward County is still blue. In fact, the Democratic presidential candidate, Vice President Kamala Harris, trounced Trump there by 16 points. Broward may be the last reliable stronghold the Democrats have left in Florida, for all we know. But given what we just heard about Miami-Dade County, the question to me is, how did the Democrats maintain their dominance up there in Broward when they would seem to have a lot of issues working against them as well? Rampant flooding, a controversial public school system, an even more controversial sheriff. What made them immune?
It might just be that residual effect that it was so strong of a stronghold that, like Josh and Wilkin both said, the kind of national party abandoning, you know, races here in Florida didn't hurt them as much. But there are signs that that's not a perfect stronghold. You know, serving mayor at the time, Nan Rich, who's been on the commission for a long time as a prominent Democrat, ran against someone who had zero ground game, very few mailers, and narrowly squeaked out a victory. So there's that. And then on the flip side, you have on the school board, all of the Republican, or it's not a nonpartisan election, but all of the candidates endorsed by the DeSantis appointees and all the ones endorsed by the major Republican groups lost on the school board. So you kind of have both things happening.
Okay, you know, so moving ahead, the Democrats in Broward may not be as immune to the red tide as I just earlier suggested.
It'd be naive to think that what happened in Miami-Dade couldn't happen in Broward or Palm Beach.
Wilkin Brutus, I want to ask you about another significant change that came to Palm Beach County in 2024, and that was the announcement by Vanderbilt University, an elite private school in Tennessee, to build a major business campus in West Palm Beach. The end game is to turn Palm Beach County into nothing less than, quote, Wall Street South. What does this say about Palm Beach County and what it wants to become? And is becoming Wall Street South the situations to problems you've covered there, particularly last year, like income disparities and housing discrimination?
Ooh, where do we start, Tim? The short answer is no. not with so much wealth concentration in areas near working class and lower income communities. Even the catchphrase that you just used, Wall Street South, is getting the shrug as of late, because although growing business activity is often seen as beneficial to a city, you know, rising tax base, more high paying jobs and capital investments, there are some unintended consequences, unintended social and economic consequences behind the growing financial sector, because there is an influx of high income professionals contributing to some of the housing affordability challenges and income inequality.
That influx often means the G word, gentrification, right?
Oh, absolutely, especially in the historic Black districts and other areas or considered working class areas. And gentrification, what does that look like? Driving up rent, higher property values, and also career opportunity issues. And so, you know, there's a lot of housing advocates who are essentially calling for more equitable development. And that means, you know, elected officials pushing for more affordable housing initiatives, more job training programs to get people into these high school sectors. And so Vanderbilt's graduate campus in West Palm Beach will place an emphasis on finance and technology industries, and officials say they plan to partner with local university and community stakeholders to create and maintain a talent pipeline. So that's going to have to include folks in those working class communities.
They'll have to do this smart. Now, Josh Ceballos and Carlton Gillespie, back south in Miami-Dade and Broward counties, one of the biggest issues of 2024 wasn't Wall Street, it was waste management. Miami-Dade is still trying to figure out where it's going to put a new multi-billion dollar garbage incinerator. Broward still can't decide whether to expand its Monarch Hill landfill, also known as Mount Trashmore. But both projects are unpopular, but both counties are running out of places to put their garbage. Josh, is Miami-Dade ever going to see this incinerator built? And if so, where?
That's the big question, Tim, going into 2025. We thought we were going to answer that question this year, but the Miami-Dade County Commission has kept punting this issue and deferring the decision to decide where are they going to put a new incinerator facility, waste-to-energy facility, after the Covanta fire in Doral a while back. They've kept punting this because there's a lot of argument. The county now says that they want to put it in the city of Doral. That's where they originally had the incinerator. But now the city of Doral is using this opportunity to say, no, we don't want the incinerator. It causes a lot of issues for our residents. When that original incinerator was built, Doral wasn't such a developed city. You know, there was a lot of land around. Now it's bustling. There's a lot of population growth, a lot of buildings. And the people who live around it are, you know, they don't want to smell the trash being burnt. Right. So there's a lot of decisions. And then
one of those residents happens to be the president-elect Donald Trump.
Exactly. So that's the new wrinkle, is president-elect Donald Trump. His son Eric has basically said, you know, you should really look somewhere else other than Doral, because Trump has the Trump Doral property there.
Golf resort.
So with that kind of threat looming over, I think the county is really nervous, and they've pushed this decision further into 2025.
Right. But again, there's a lot of talk about, well, let's not build an incinerator. Let's go for approaches like more recycling, more compost, more what they call zero waste. Mm-hmm. But do a lot of experts think that's really practical?
I don't think so. I mean, the Miami-Dade Mayor Daniela Levin-Cava has said that she wants to increase recycling and increase zero waste solutions. But Miami-Dade County has double the average of, you know, waste production. We're throwing away a lot of garbage all the time. I think just going cold turkey and going to zero waste is not going to be feasible in the next couple of years.
Right. So the incinerator is going to happen. It's just we still have to figure out where.
Right now they're just shipping trash out on trains.
Exactly.
So that's not feasible.
That's not feasible either. Carlton, ditto in Broward. What's going to happen with that landfill? And if nothing happens, where does that take the county's garbage crisis in Broward?
Well, the plan now is to decide whether to raise the height of the landfill by another 100 feet. That would bring it up to 325 feet. It's taller than the Statue of Liberty.
Ah.
It would also expand the horizontal footprint of the landfill, which would include a site that used to have a waste-to-energy or an incinerator on it. Yeah. Now, cities, it's kind of like Josh says, no one wants this in their backyard. The cities of Coconut Creek, Deerfield, and Pompano that abut this are all vehemently opposed to, frankly, yet another landfill height increase that's increased steadily over the past 20 years. and the commissions that represent areas like Southwest Ranches, Miramar, where feasibly a new incinerator site could be, if they don't raise the landfill height, would go, are on the other side of this. So there's a big battle of where it's going to happen. The undercurrent of all this is that Broward County has gotten their solid waste authority to develop a master plan that is not ready yet.
Oh.
So the commission is going to meet in January to decide whether or not to raise the height of this landfill before the final master plan is published. Waste management is pushing them to move along faster, and the opponents are waiting for to see what the results of this master plan could be. So still a ton up in the air there.
A lot of trash in South Florida's future this year. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. I'm speaking with WLRN's Joshua Ceballos, Carlton Gillespie, and Wilkin Brutus about the year that was and will be in South Florida. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. So if there was one issue that gripped all of South Florida in 2024, it was the affordable housing crisis, which of course entailed the problems of homelessness too, as well as condo panic, that tide of significantly higher fees Florida condo owners now face under new state laws designed to make condo buildings safer in the wake of the Surfside disaster. Wilkin Brutus, let's start with you. You did an important report recently on how this affects folks in Palm Beach County. How big of a housing earthquake did this become last year and promises to remain this coming year?
Yeah, housing earthquake. I wish we used that term more often. It's just really important to point out that the young generation of people on fixed incomes who are entering their prime years, new careers, perhaps saving up for marriage and children, are also taking a huge hit from the condo crisis. It's a generational impact. And so it's not just older people facing a financial strain. I actually spoke to a firefighter who put his condo up for sale because his estimated increase in assessment for his unit in West Palm Beach is about $800 a month extra, which is on top of his already $600 in HOA payments. And so, you know, this young condo owner decided to sell his condo to put it on a market. And meanwhile, condominiums across Palm Beach County and obviously across the state are hoping for reforms during the regular session in March.
Right. Josh Ceballos, in Miami-Dade County, we faced a sort of double jeopardy in 2024, an acute shortage of affordable housing, especially rental units, and at the same time, new laws cracking down on homeless persons living and sleeping in public spaces. Is this situation sustainable moving forward?
I don't think anyone, in their right mind would think that this situation right now is sustainable. I mean, it's not just a housing affordability crisis. I think it's just an affordability crisis going on around Miami-Dade County, around South Florida, with the condo fees, with rental prices going up, as well as insurance costs going
up. Yes, thank you for reminding us of that. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think just living in South Florida is the, you know, the cooker, the hot pot is getting hotter. And with these laws about the homeless person sleeping outside, it's now illegal for a person to sleep in public spaces. And starting this year, now officially, an individual can sue their municipality if they are not enforcing this ban on public sleeping.
Yeah.
So a lot of experts in the homelessness field that I've spoken to are really worried that this is going to be a perfect storm where municipalities are going to be arresting homeless people, because if not, they're going to be paying huge fees in legal fees.
Yeah.
And also the homeless people have less protection now because of a Supreme Court decision last year,
right,
that made it so cities and municipalities can basically illegalize homelessness.
Yeah. Carlton Gillespie, you recently covered a so-called condo summit in Broward County, where both Democratic and Republican state legislators told condo owners it's time for a reality check. What did 2024 tell us about how unrealistic Floridians have been for too long about our beloved condo lifestyle?
Yeah, and that reality check is a bill that is coming due, according to both State Senator Jason Pizzo and Republican Jennifer Bradley. Both of them told me that for years now, the state has a law that says condos must fill their reserves, and they also have allowed condo associations to waive that requirement. So for years, condos have not been putting money away like they should have. Their buildings are in structural and financial bad health, and it's time to fix it after the Surfside collapse in 2021. Mm-hmm. Their both sides are surprisingly very stubborn in not moving. That kind of the relief,
that was evident,
the bailout that is not coming.
That was evident last year.
And I think condo owners have been getting off scot-free and living easy, and that's coming to an end. And like Wilkin said, it hurts young condo owners. I'm a young condo owner myself, and we're going to lose value on what should have been an appreciating asset for us for a long time. So it's got a multi-generational impact.
Wilkin Brutus, there was perhaps a lesser known change in Palm Beach County in 2024, and that was West Palm Beach adopting, along with cities like New York, street cameras powered by artificial intelligence. Officials hope it will make West Palm Beach a new, quote, smart city. But this is controversial moving forward, no? Can you quickly tell us about that?
Yeah, definitely a complex issue to cover. So the Smart City Project in downtown West Palm Beach isn't so much controversial as it is simply under the radar for a lot of city residents. The 5-year, $26 million camera project essentially improves, or at least aims to improve, safer crosswalks, transportation, parking, accessibility. But details about the camera usage still remains unclear until community input meetings are complete. And so, Tim, as you can imagine, in an era of growing video surveillance, there's a lot of fears surrounding privacy and data protection concerns. And so engineering experts involved told me they're working on several safety mechanisms, like technology that will shield the recording of people's faces or, quote, de-identify individuals. And so there's a huge campaign to inform the public.
That'll be interesting. Joshua Ceballos, we can't end a discussion of Miami in 2024 without fondly reminiscing about what the South Florida Roundup often called the Miami mess. That is, the seemingly endless stream of ethics controversies and other dysfunction that cast an even bigger than usual shadow on the Magic City's image last year. The mayor, the city manager, the city council, housing discrimination. Where did it all leave the city of Miami, and how does it ever going to dig out of the deep optics hole it's dug for itself now?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like every time I'm on the show, Tim, we're talking about the Miami mess. So just to run it through, I mean, the city manager was sort of looked at for a possible conflict of interest for hiring his wife's family company to furnish his home. And the city attorney was pushed out after our reporting on some guardianship issues. The mayor has been under investigation. Two city commissioners have had lawsuits against them. And it creates this thing, this sense of dysfunction in the city of Miami, where a lot of residents come in and think, you know, you guys are working against us. This whole city commission, whether they have good intentions or not, the residents feel like they can't win with these people. And I think that's going to have to change in the coming year. They really have to engage with the community a lot more and rebuild that trust, because if not, it's right now at the city commission during public comment, it's a very us versus them dynamic on both sides.
Yeah. Now, finally, Carlton, I want to end with you here because perhaps the funnest story of 2024 here was the Florida Panthers winning the National Hockey League Stanley Cup.
A dream 30 years in the making is a reality. Whoa! The Florida Panthers have won the Stanley Cup.
Lord Stanley is coming home. You always will have a place in South Florida.
Okay, so Carlton, how historic was this? And since the Panthers play in Sunrise, how important was this triumph to the folks in Broward County who have to live in Miami-Dade's shadow all the time when it comes to other major sports?
This is Broward's professional sports team, so it means a lot to people. And it's been kind of a years-long buildup of this fan base that was kind of destitute, as they had some very bad teams for a long time. Slowly, as the team got better, the fans started showing up, and it's really transformed into a very, very passionate fan base. So that night, I was at a watch party watching Game 7 at the Panthers practice arena. You know, it was 500, 600 people. They all counted down the last 10 seconds in unison. The place went crazy. I mean, people were crying. It was unbelievable. And then to play a part of the very cool tradition of the Stanley Cup being passed around by the players and showing up in the ocean or at a pizza restaurant.
They had a heck of a lot of fun.
Yeah, I interviewed Phil Pritchard, who was the man who watches the Stanley Cup, and it was just such a cool process to have that happen here. And don't look now, but the last 5 Stanley Cups have all featured a Florida team, and no Canadian team has won it since 1990. So maybe a balance in power in the hockey world here in South Florida.
No, that'll be fun. Carlton Gillespie is WLRN's Broward County reporter. Joshua Ceballos is WLRN's government accountability reporter. And Wilkin Brutus is WLRN's Palm Beach County reporter. Gentlemen, thanks as always, and Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year,
always
everyone.
A pleasure.
Still to come, a brief look back and ahead at the arts in South Florida. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. The arts matter in South Florida, and so we can't really look back on 2024 without considering how we fared culturally and what's ahead for this remarkably multicultural community in 2025. WLRN digital producer Alyssa Ramos edits AC, our new arts and culture newsletter, and she joins me now to look at a few of the year's more important arts stories. Alyssa, Happy New Year.
Happy New Year, Tim. Thanks.
We can't escape the fact that one of the biggest South Florida art stories of 2024 was also a political story. And I'm talking, of course, about Governor Ron DeSantis' controversial defunding of arts programs throughout the state. How hard did this impact arts and culture institutions here?
Yeah, I believe that's been the biggest art story of 2024 because it's been creating ripple effects that we've seen throughout the arts community. For those who don't know, this past June, Governor Ron DeSantis vetoed $32 million mm-hmm. in arts funding, and that slashed from the 2024-2025 state budget. And that was a surprise for people in the arts community because year to year, they rely on these state grants to help with salaries, utilities, bills, and like rental fees. And so it was surprising, and it came around a time when these organizations also submit grant proposals.
Yeah.
And so it really left them scrambling to figure out, okay, what do we do now?
Right.
And
but that takes mm-hmm. us to what was just as big a story, how arts and culture institutions, as well as local governments, found innovative ways to make up for that funding shortfall, right?
For sure. I mean, aside from, you know, streamlining and cutting the programs that they already have, and, you know, they're trying to avoid that, a lot of alternative solutions were just seeking donations. And in some cases, local governments really stepped up, like the city of Miami Beach gave yeah. like a one-time fund. I believe it was $500,000 to be distributed among 16 mm-hmm. different Miami Beach-based arts and cultural institutions. But that's just one example of ways, mm-hmm. you know, the community is stepping up. And, you know, I'm sure you've seen it online.
Well, now, along those lines, I know another important arts development WLRN covered last year was what's known as an artist census here. Tell us what that was all about.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And it came at a really good time with this, you know, these budget cuts, because there's been a lack of hard data on what the art community needs. So earlier this year, a collective of Miami-based artists found they created a census, basically asking questions about, you know, salary, access to healthcare, future prospects of work. And a lot of people found, like, you know, it was hard to find studio space. You know, yeah. most of the data that you usually find is talking about, like, you know, big picture, like what was the economic impact of this arts event, not like what the individual artist mm-hmm. really needs.
Yeah, because even that what used to be cheap warehouse space in Wynwood is now becoming exorbitant for artists, right?
Yeah, and it's not for like a lack of trying on like artist parts. Like, it's just you can't work from home as artist in some as an artist in some cases. Like, you might need specialized equipment, like yeah. a kiln, or like maybe you work with industrial material, and so that studio space is critical. And, you know, there are lots of nonprofits that offer subsidized spaces, mm-hmm. But the wait list is long, and, you know, it's
so the census could help out in that situation, or help out that with that dilemma for a lot of artists.
Indeed, yeah. And I would just also mention that even though it says a Miami art census, it's really for anyone in South Florida.
Ah, okay.
Yeah, just because you know, a lot of artists may not be able to afford to live in an expensive place like Miami, and they'll you know, be pushed out to other neighborhoods as well.
Now, WLRN also produced an important series of reports last year called Culture of Neglect, looking at a number of historic arts and culture landmarks that have sadly been allowed to fall into disrepair. I get the feeling it jolted a lot of people here when they heard about this. So does it look like some of these places may now get a new lease on life in 2025?
Well, to be specific, we looked at four places: Tower Theater, the Little Haiti Cultural Complex, the Olympia Theater, and the Miami Marine Stadium in this series. And, you know, I haven't seen that much programming from, like, Tower Theater or the Olympia Theater. You know, it's still early to tell. But I would say, like, there's hope with the Little Haiti Cultural Complex. They reopened in October, you know, after they had a leaky roof and other, like, issues, and they expect to get those repairs addressed in early 2025 or 2026. You know, so there's hope, and, you know, they've reopened to more programming. And I noticed that the Miami Marine Stadium, they hosted the Country Bay Music Festival, which was interesting. I should note that I didn't actually see that it was like held in the stadium itself, but, you know, they set up a stage next to it. So.
But this is also a good reminder that we do have a number of new arts and culture institutions in the pipeline in South Florida. Miami Gardens in 2024 announced plans for a new $70 million arts center. West Palm Beach just last month received a $500,000 grant to build a major new Black History Museum and Research Center in the city's historic Coleman Park neighborhood. So do things look fairly positive on the arts and culture facilities front in South Florida, from what you can see?
From what I can see, I've seen several municipalities in South Florida really trying to build their own cultural arts hubs, and I don't blame them. I mean, you know, the city of Miami and surrounding areas, it's not necessarily accessible to people. You know, that's where a lot of arts programming is. And so I would understand why, like, cities and local governments would want to boost the arts programming like right in their backyard. But I'm curious to I'm a bit of a cynic, so
as any good journalist should be.
And I mean, as we've seen with the Culture of Neglect series, you know, it's one thing to get something built, but it's another thing to maintain it. So you know, I think it's a good start, but we'll have to see.
Now, what about the South Florida vanguard pop culture scene, which is very vibrant here? Alyssa, I'm old, you're young. Tell me what's caught your attention on the pop music front.
Oh, I love talking about music, so this is excellent. A lot of people may know Bad Bunny is releasing a new album this Sunday, and it's called, pardon my horrible, like, Spanish, but Debí Tirar Más Fotos, or I Should Have Taken More Photos. And I'm always excited to see what kind of music he, you know, he brings, and I know it'll be a talker. I'm very excited for the Grammys because Doechii, she's a Florida-based artist. She's from Tampa, but she's been nominated for Best Rap Album of the Year.
But you mentioned a Miami-based band, though, that you're really looking forward to see what they're going to be doing in 2025.
Yes, yes. So there's this Miami-based band called Las Nubes. You know, they
which means in Spanish, the clouds.
Yeah. Yes, definitely. And they released a new album, and they'll be touring soon. They'll be performing at the Miami Beach Bandshell in March. And so I'm really excited to see them on this.
What's their music like?
It's interesting. It's going to be one of those, like, slash this, slash that. Like, I would say, you know, alternative, dreamy pop, shoegaze. So not like your normal pop, but, you know, it's very interesting and I like it a lot.
Cool. Finally, we should mention some new arts leadership in 2024. Maria Todaro took over as general director of Florida Grand Opera, and renowned Haitian-American contemporary artist Edouard Duval-Carrier was named Miami-Dade County's new artist-in-residence. So do things look good for the arts in South Florida in 2025, despite all the challenges they faced in 2024, Alyssa?
I do. I do believe that because, you know, with a new change of leadership, there's new vision, new perspective, and change is always good. It's constant. And I think artists are used to being creative and trying to deal with the challenges ahead. So we've always had a thriving art scene, and I think we will continue to have a thriving art scene. It will just depend on what that looks like for next year.
Alyssa Ramos is WLRN digital producer and editor of our new arts and culture newsletter, AC. Alyssa, thanks and Happy New Year.
Thank you. Happy New Year.
Still to come, looking back and ahead in that other important South Florida community, Latin America and the Caribbean. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. One of our mottos here at WLRN is that in South Florida, Latin America and the Caribbean are a local story. And so it goes when we look back on the old year and look ahead to the new year. We can't and shouldn't decouple what happens here from what we're seeing in Cuba, Venezuela, Haiti, Nicaragua, Puerto Rico, Colombia, or Brazil. Take last summer's Venezuelan election, which dictator Nicolas Maduro brutally stole, but which we know he lost thanks to the vigilant vote observation cells that secured the actual vote tally sheets, and which were organized thanks in no small part to the efforts of Venezuelan expats here in South Florida, as WLRN was the first to report. So many issues we deal with here, not the least of which is immigration, have connections to the places of so many of us here call home. What do you consider the most important stories and issues of 2024 in Latin America and the Caribbean, and what will be most important to watch in 2025? Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Joining me now to scan the region looking back and ahead is our friend Eduardo Gamarra, political science professor at Florida International University and one of our community's top Latin America experts. Eduardo, thanks as always coming on, and Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you too, and thanks for having me one more time.
Well, and this will be not the last, hardly. How would you characterize, Eduardo, 2024 in Latin America and the Caribbean? We did see the first woman president elected in Mexico, Claudia Sheinbaum, for example. But otherwise, it was hard for me to find much good news in the region last year. I mean, even where we did see positive developments like the drop in El Salvador's gang homicides, it was coupled with the reminder that in the process, Salvadoran President Nayib Bukele has trampled on the country's constitution and civil rights. So what's your assessment overall?
I mean, it's similar to yours, Tim. The region had a not very stellar performance on the economic side, very, very slow growth. It had an extraordinary expansion of organized crime. It had, as you mentioned, an electoral process that produced the first female president in Mexico, but in a country that is ravaged by organized crime, by enormous violence. And if you just scan the rest of the region, you have this extraordinary process of polarization, that in many ways has produced probably the worst immigration thrust, not just this hemisphere, but perhaps worldwide.
Yeah, and we're going to get to all that, but I want to start off with what was arguably the biggest Latin American story of 2024, the Venezuelan presidential election I mentioned at the outset. No one argues now that incumbent dictator President Nicolas Maduro and his socialist regime lost by a landslide and then declared victory anyway, and then jailed 2,000 people for protesting it. The U.S. and most of the rest of the world recognize opposition candidate Edmundo Gonzalez as the actual winner. Next Friday, January 10th, is the presidential inauguration in Venezuela, and there's been talk of flying Gonzalez into Venezuela to take the oath, but that doesn't sound likely. So, Eduardo, is there any chance of ever getting Maduro to step down at this point? And if there isn't, what sort of effect is this going to have on the region moving forward?
Well, as you just pointed out, in fact, since July, Maduro's grip on power has consolidated.
Yeah.
It has not weakened. And everything seems to suggest that he will swear himself in on January the 10th, and it will be very difficult to get him out, even with the coming of a new administration in Washington. Now, the legitimate winner is himself embarking. In fact, if it's not today, it's certainly in the next few hours, he will be meeting with President Milei of Argentina.
Right.
And as well in community in Buenos
Aires. We should point out that Edmundo Gonzalez was forced into exile in Spain in September. But as you point out now, he's going to be traveling to Argentina to meet with President Milei there.
Right. So so you have these two coalitions, let us say, the leftist coalition supported, of course, by Russia, by Iran, to a certain extent by China, although China is a bit more pragmatic about it. But you have this attempt by the right to create a similar group supporting the legitimate elected president. But who has the all of the strings right now is Maduro, and I think short of a military intervention, which will not happen, I don't see Maduro stepping down.
And given the fact that Maduro is responsible for the worst modern or the worst humanitarian crisis in modern South American history, one of the big effects of all this could be an even worse immigration crisis coming out of Venezuela. And I know, as you mentioned earlier, you feel the hemisphere's immigration crisis in general was if not the biggest stories last year. What stood out for you the most?
Well, if you think about 8 million people leaving a country,
A quarter of its population.
Just because of the economic situation and the combined political mismanagement that has happened there, and which is likely to continue, by the way. We're likely to see, despite everything, in fact, if you look at some recent news reports, people are still leaving and people are still coming. And you have all of these new so-called caravans that have been forming in southern Mexico and so on. And a majority of those people are Venezuelans. And knowing full well that there is a promise to deport them as soon as they arrive, they are still willing to leave, to walk basically from Venezuela all the way to the southern part of the United States. So unless something dramatic happens in Venezuela, and by the way, the continuation of sanctions on Venezuela is something, of course, that's going to be very much debated because in the context right now, getting Venezuela to stop immigration and for that matter, to accept deportees might be negotiated in terms of sanctions. In other words, take deportees and we will lift sanctions.
Well, we have a caller on the line who would like to weigh in on these subjects. Welcome to the South Florida Roundup. Nice to meet you. And what are your thoughts?
Hi, this is your social studies teacher speaking. Yes, my thoughts are the question of whether America is still holding Venezuelan gold hostage as part of our sanctions, and how are Cuban migrants reacting to the end of their basic income they had enjoyed for decades?
I'm sorry, income referring to what, sir?
Well, Cuban migrants had been enjoying certain benefits almost no other migrants had,
Oh,
even.
you're referring to the immigration policy benefits, not income.
Right.
Eduardo,
even Marco Rubio complained about that.
Right.
In
Eduardo, can you answer that question about this gold hoard that a lot of people still talk about when it comes to, how we can freeze Venezuelan assets, for example?
Well, that I think is it's a very good question because in many ways the debate right now, most people expect, most of this community expects the incoming administration to deepen the sanctions, to be much more restrictive on sanctions. Yet one of the only declarations the president elect Trump made about Venezuela was the possibility, in fact, of negotiating ex the acceptance of deportees for lifting sanctions. So we really don't know what the new administration will do with Venezuela. The expectation is greater sanctions, and those include everything from minerals and so on. But my sense is that probably the incoming administration is going to work with sanctions in a very, very different fa fashion.
Now, along these lines, a lot of the complaint in the hemisphere about immigration that it is also helped stoke crime, like, for example, the Venezuelan crime gang known as the Tren de Aragua. I know you also feel that the resurgence of violent crime, especially violent drug crime, Eduardo, was a major development in the region last year. Again, what alarmed you the most?
Well, it's interesting because there are several reports now that have come out in the context of the last few weeks, which show you that, for example, South American cocaine, which is coming at rates that are that far exceed what was going on during Pablo Escobar, for example, the heyday of the so-called war on drugs.
Right, Escobar being the top Colombian drug lord of the 1980s. Right. Yeah.
But today, what you have in especially in South America is the presence of Albanian, Turkish, African. Of course, the usual Mexican cartels, Brazilian organizations that are huge and that are spread out all over the hemisphere and which have penetrated most governments today, most police institutions, most law enforcement is essentially penetrated by these organizations. And so you also have this enormous demand for cocaine.
Right.
Coming from Europe.
Yep.
And then to all of that, you have to add the crisis of fentanyl that we're facing in this country and which is largely coming through Mexico.
Through Mexico, right.
Now, even reports of fentanyl labs in places like Guatemala.
Yeah.
Right. And of course, the Chinese connection is there as well. So so that to me is an issue that's going to get worse before it begins to get better.
This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. I'm looking back at 2024 in Latin America and the Caribbean and ahead to 2025 with FIU's Eduardo Gomara. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. But Eduardo, when we talk about Latin American and Caribbean organized crime in 2024, we have to point out that violent and powerful gangs now control much of Haiti. Did you ever expect that the gang terror there would get as bad as it did last year? And will the U.S. and the U.N. have any choice now in the coming year but to create a new international peacekeeping force, militarized presumably, to go in and save the country?
Tim, you know, this is such a recurring question because if you go back to the 1990s when then President Aristide was overthrown, there was talk about, you know, establishing some kind of protectorate in Haiti because Haiti could not self-govern. And today, many people are again suggesting this idea of a protectorate in Haiti, given that dramatic situation where there is basically no state. I've argued that, you know, it's not a failed state because you have to have a state to begin with.
Right.
I've said that, you know, that Haiti is in a situation of complete anomie, where basically all, it's not just that there's no authority, but all sense of values has essentially inverted. And so those who are governing today are gangs who are targeting things like hospitals,
yeah,
right? Or destroying everything in the context of, I don't know what political objective they might even have, but certainly most of it is tied to organized crime. It's
right.
it's human trafficking, it's trafficking of arms, and enormous presence of drugs in Haiti.
Yeah.
So I think you have to put this in a context where the international community, which has been tired of dealing with Haiti,
yeah,
is going to have to play a larger role than it has played, because
right,
this is a major humanitarian crisis.
And finally, Eduardo, this is Miami, so of course we also have to look back on the awful year Cuba just had and how things could get even worse there in 2025. Do you see Trump tightening the economic and diplomatic screws on the island, or is the communist regime doing a good enough job destroying itself on its own, especially with the astonishing moves it made last year to suffocate the private sector, the only thing in Cuba that actually works?
Well, again, it's important to note who are the main people involved now in the making of policy toward Latin America, and they happen to be Cuban Americans. One, of course, is Senator Rubio, and the other is Mauricio Claver Carrón,
yeah,
who's very well known in this community as well. So,
yeah,
if we go by what they have said,
That could be the signal, yeah. I'm sorry, Eduardo. Unfortunately, we're out of time. Eduardo Gomara is a political science professor and Latin America expert at Florida International University. Eduardo, thanks as always, and Happy New Year.
You too, Tim. Thank you.
Finally on the roundup, here's how you stick with New Year's goals, folks. 74-year-old Robert Raven Kraft of Miami Beach hit a big milestone this week. He's run on the beach every single day for 50 years. WLRN's Jimena Romero caught up with him.
Every afternoon, you can catch Robert Raven Kraft at the same lifeguard station getting ready for his daily run.
In the beginning, I did this for myself because it made me feel better. And after a while, everybody started coming out, so now I come out for them. Even on rainy, stormy days, I'm here.
It started as a New Year's resolution in 1974. Now, people travel from all around the world just to run with him. William Troy Donahoe lives 6 hours away in Gainesville. When he's in Miami, he joins Raven.
I sometimes have enough trouble getting in a mile or two every day, no matter where I'm at, and for him, the consistency is just amazing.
Raven's pace is not the same as it was when he started, and last year he had to reduce his 8-mile run to 5 miles due to chronic back pain. But he has no plans of stopping.
Any kind of back problems you could have, I got them. So it ain't easy, but I ain't quitting. I'm still going.
The city of Miami Beach will name 3rd Street Robert Ravenscroft Way in his honor. I'm Jimena Romero on Miami Beach.
That will do it for the South Florida Roundup. If you missed any part of the show, you can always search for the South Florida Roundup podcast in the NPR app or wherever you listen to podcasts. The show was produced by Jimena Romero with help from Polly Landis. Katie Munoz is our director of original live programming. Mateo Sanchez is digital editor. Sergio Bustos is WLRN's vice president of news. The vice president of radio and the show's technical supervisor is Peter J. Mertz. Richard Ives answers the phones. I'm Tim Padgett. Have a great weekend. And thanks for listening. Happy New Year, Feliz Año, Bon Anné, Feliz Ano Novo.
WLRN.